thank God for that. The speaker we have tonight, George E., I don't even really know where to begin with him. Excuse me. I met George probably 4 or 5 years ago. And when I met George, it was right before I started doing the AA shuffle, when you shuffle in the door and shuffle back out the door over and over again. And the thing about it is that every time I shuffled back in the door, there were a few familiar faces, and one of those familiar faces was George. Every time that myself or anyone else that I saw that came back in after a run, George was there and his hand was extended. George is in service. He sponsors a lot of men. He has a home group. And he, to me, is the epitome of AA. He came up and helped us out and spoke a couple months ago. And when we asked him then, he didn't even halter. He didn't even ask any questions. He said, yes, I'll be there. And he did the same thing this time. And I can see, you know, some of the reasons why George is sober today and why he has such gratitude for it. He does things like this, you know, without even asking questions. I could go on all night and talk about the wonderful things about George, but I'm going to let him come up here and share his experience, strength, and hope with you. And y'all, please help me welcome George E.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you, Joey, very much. You said a lot of nice, wonderful things, and I'm going to tell you about all the unwonderful things. My name is George. I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering drug since October the 26th, 1966. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. And I'm sure God appreciates your applause. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a young man. It's hard to believe that right now, but I was 27 years old. And back in 1966, 27-year-old was like a 13-year-old today. It was very few young people. Matter of fact, the group that I came into, the guy that sponsored me, was 16 years older than I was, and he was the kid of the group until I got there. Now, I walked into a meeting of a bunch of old guys that looked like I do now, and I'm not really sure I wanted what they had, but I know I wanted to stay sober. And those old guys loved me sober. They love me so. The guys that never went out, I mean, they were in bed at 8:30. They would go out at the meeting, after the meeting with me, and have coffee and eat ice cream. And I knew they were way out late past their bedtime, you know. But I'm grateful for that. And I had a little Jewish man down in the Outer Banks by the name of Isaac, who was like my daddy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Isaac used to say, George, he said, you know, thank God God gave us mercy instead of justice. Because if he'd have given us justice, neither one of us would have been here. We'd have been in jail, or we'd have been dead, or somewhere else. And I believe that. And I'm grateful for the God of my understanding, because he brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love all this tonight, because of the enthusiasm, and it's awesome. It's really great. And little Isaac, to tell you a little bit about him, he was the one when he came to AA, he heard him say, there are no dues or fees in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he thought they were saying no Jews or thieves. And he was both. That's why I loved him so dearly. But, you know, I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous being young, you know, 27 years old. My deal, you know, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. First of all, my idea of an alcoholic was someone that was laying over by the bridge, under the bridge. They had a long overcoat on in July. They didn't have a wristwatch. They had patent leather shoes. Their feet would pat out the bottom of their soles and pat the cement. And that was my idea of an alcoholic, and they were old. I mean, real, real old. I mean, way older than I am. I mean, they were just old. So I wasn't that. You know, I didn't meet that. I was young. I was 27 years old. I still had my family. I didn't own an overcoat. Now, back where I came from in West Virginia, that's not a very good idea to not own an overcoat. And I had a wristwatch. It was an old beat-up Timex. It didn't keep time. It twice a day, it was right. And so when I walked in here, you know, and that guy, the man that sponsored me into Alcoholics Anonymous said, you know something, son? Now, let me tell you something. I am not, you know, I think everything that we alcoholics go through are circumstances. You know, people sit up here and they want to say, well, you know, I didn't drink like them or I didn't do that. Now, I went to jail a lot. But that had nothing to do with my alcoholism, you know, and it had nothing to do with what we call bottom in Alcoholics Anonymous. The man that brought me into AA told me what a bottom was, and I believe that to this day. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous was started by a stockbroker, a doctor, and a lawyer. And none of those are under the bridge, believe me. Now, their practices weren't doing too well, but they were not... They were not what we call street drunks. But you know what? All three of them, someone had diagnosed as hopeless. And everybody sitting out in that audience tonight, I guarantee you, someone has diagnosed you as hopeless. If you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, that's your bottom. Because I was diagnosed as hopeless. Because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was at a point in my life where I couldn't drink and I couldn't quit drinking. My children were afraid of me. My first wife. Now, here we go. First wife. That in itself, when we start talking about multiple wives, we're alcoholic, you know. And my first wife was leaving me. My mother had disowned me. And she was a very fine Christian lady, and I mean, just the most loving person. And that's the biggest act of love she ever did for me. She disowned me. Now, as soon as I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, believe me, I was the baby boy back again, you know, and mama's good graces. But so, you know, I was at a point in my life that everything was just was bad. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the man I came to, he started explaining this to me. You know, he started explaining to me about alcoholism. You know, and he said, George, he said, alcoholism. And he said something to me the very first day that I practice every day of my life that I believe. And that is, he said, alcoholism's an illness, and the only recovery from is spiritual. And I believe that. I believe that to this day. I've never, you know, I had a friend of mine that used to ask him to speak at professional places, you know, and they'd say, and they'd always introduce him, you know, he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, said, one of the ways we stay sober, you know. Now, he went to those meetings a lot after that. He never heard of another way to stay sober, but they always said, one of the ways we stay sober. But, you know, I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, you know, I am Alcoholics Anonymous. I will be grateful because it returned me to my church. You know, and I know we're not up here talking about church, and I'm not going to tell you what church it is, but it returned me to my church, and I'm grateful for that. But I couldn't get sober in church. You know, when I was going down, I was like all through my alcoholism. I started drinking when I was 13, and I do not know anything about social drinking. The only social drinking I know is that I used to go in a bar and somebody would say, I shall have a drink. And I said, so shall I. You know? And, but you see, I drank to oblivion every time I took a drink. From the very first time I took a drink of liquor, I drank to oblivion. I didn't know what it was to, you know, to, I guess, social drink or whatever they do. So, but in this alcoholism, I would go to church. You know, I've been dipped, re-dipped, undipped, dedicated, rededicated. I've taken a dive for a bowl of soup. I've done the whole thing. And you see, what happened to me in church is that I would get rapture in like 15 minutes. But after I walked out on the street, it was gone. Now, my sponsor explained that to me this way. He said, you know, most major religions and philosophies are going to tell you to change your thinking and your actions will change. He said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're going to tell you the exact opposite. Change your actions and your thinking will change. And believe me, that's what a spiritual awakening is. You know, if you do the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't help but have a spiritual awakening in the 12th step. So anyway, this is where I was when I walked in AA. And of course, he mentioned something else. And he said that alcoholism was like a threefold illness, that it was mental, physical, and spiritual. And I always like to talk about recovery. And I really don't like to get into a drunkologue and tell you about drinking. But I got sober up near where AA was started, up near Akron, Ohio, in Marietta. In Marietta, Ohio. And if you get up there and you don't qualify yourself as an alcoholic, someone's going to ask you to come down from the podium. You know, they're not going to listen to somebody, you know, that was laying around the house and decide they come to AA and change their life, you know. So the way I like to qualify real quick is to tell you how I was when I came at 27 years old into AA in those three areas of my life. Physically, I weighed about 270. I was bloated. I didn't have to go to a treatment center, but back then there wasn't any treatment centers. The only one was probably Hazleton, and that was way far away from me. But I was, I could walk a drunk off. I was in a small town, so, you know, I'd just walk and when I wanted to get sober or try to get sober. So physically, you know, I didn't go to a treatment center, although I did go to two of them in my hometown. I went to two treatment centers, city and the county. My sponsor used to say, you can get sober if you want to. All you have to do is slap a cop. Well, now I'm telling you, I did slap a cop. I was 17 years old. I was coming through Georgia drunk, half drunk. You know, we always say half drunk. But and a cop stopped me, and I don't know what, for whatever reason, I got out of the car, and I hit him. Now, I'm here to tell you this was a long time ago, and it was before Rodney King. And that man explained to me why you don't hit cops. I'm telling you. I never hit another one. I went to jail a lot after that, but I never hit another cop. Because when he got me in that jail cell, and he had my hands cuffed behind me, and he took out a rubber hose or whatever they used, he put some hurting on me. The next morning, you couldn't see a mark, but you could see pain. Or you could feel pain. I didn't try to do that anymore. I went to jail. When they said, you're going to jail, I said, yes, sir, whatever. Of course, I was always a two-charge guy. You know, I was never just one charge. It was public drunkenness plus something else, you know, whatever. So anyway... Physically, that's where I was. Now, mentally is another story. You know, mentally, it's just like the book talks about. You know, we walk around with impending doom, and I did that. I was afraid of everything. I was scared to death. I was, you know, I get in the house when I'd lose my sea legs, or you know, when I get drunk, I'd hole up in the house and couldn't get out. But I wouldn't answer the phone. I wouldn't answer the door. I'd peek out the windows. You know, I was like Bill Wilson used to call us children of the night. I like that. You know, it sounds good. And that's what I was, you know. I didn't go out in the daytime because I know they'd see you back in the daytime. And scared to death. I had a butcher knife under the bed, and I had all the radios on and television and everything, you know, and lights all over the house. And absolutely scared to death. I had another problem with the mental part of my illness, and I don't know if any of you can relate to it or not, but I was the type of drunk that couldn't watch Ben Casey or Dr. Kildare on television. Because every night they had whatever disease was on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning I had it. Now I'm here to tell you I've had every disease known to mankind. I've had elephantitis, never been out of the country. I've had everything. I was pregnant twice. Fortunately, I aborted, but it's funny to talk about now, but it was not funny back then. It really was not. You know, when I was like 23 years old, I was a traveling salesman, and I used to get up, and in a small town, you have one doctor. And that doctor sees everybody, and you just get in line and go there. Well, I used to have these heart attacks a lot. And so one morning, I went over there for 13 straight days, every morning. Go over and said, "Doc, do you think I'm going to make it?" He saw, "George, you're fine." He put me on the EKG machine, you know, and he'd do all this stuff. He said, "You're fine, go to work." So the 14th day, I went about 50 miles from home at a big industrial complex, and I was in a purchasing agent's office, and I was trying to sell him product. And it was about 8:30 in the morning. I hadn't had a drink yet that morning. But all of a sudden, the big one hit. You know the one Red Fox talks about? I mean, the big one. So I looked across the desk, and I told this guy that I was trying to sell product to. I said, "You know, you're going to have to excuse me because I'm dying. While you're watching me, I'm dying. And I'm going to go try to save, you know, try to be saved at my home." So I called that wife that was leaving me, and this is one of the reasons I think she's leaving me, and I told her to make arrangements at the hospital because, you know, if they could save me, I'd be grateful. But I knew I was dying. And so I went in the hospital, and she had packed one of the little ditty bags for me, you know, and I walked up to the admitting, and they said, you're in room 324. Well, I wasn't too rum-dumb at that point that I knew that 324 probably was on the third floor. So I picked up the ditty bag and I walked to go, and she said, "No, no." Now here I'm 23 years old now. She said, "You can't walk. We got to get a wheelchair." So they wheelchaired me up to the third floor. And I knew that I'd never make it from the third floor. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, at that time I worked for my family. And I was at this was before my mother had disowned me, and she was secretary or treasurer of this little company. It was a little small company. And my dad was an alcoholic. Now, I know we're not supposed to call anybody an alcoholic. And there was, you know, my sponsor used to say, you know, if you look like a duck, walk like a duck, and talk like a duck, you're a duck. Well, my dad was ducky, I can tell you. And this doctor diagnosed it real quick. He said, "You know, you're overworked and you've got hypertension." Okay. Well, I explained that about my dad because I wanted to explain to you how overworked I was. My dad and I didn't see eye to eye, so he'd fire me every week. And that was fine with me. You know, I'd go down to the pool room and just stay there and get drunk all day long and just, you know, like I was working. The trouble with that is we got paid every 2 weeks. And my mother was the treasurer. And she wrote out the checks. And if her baby boy wasn't on the payroll, he didn't get a check. So he'd hire me back every other week. So I'd stay long enough so we both could get a check, and then I'd go out again. You know. So that's what, you know, so when I came in, I was unemployable, employed, if it's possible. Everything's possible for an alcoholic. But anyway, so there's where all the deal was going, you know, mental, and all this stuff was just going on with my alcoholism. Spiritually was another deal. Spiritually, I was raised in a fundamentalist church in West Virginia, and I love them. Don't get me wrong. I'm not making fun of them. But the type of church my mother went to, now, if they didn't build that church by a river or a stream so they could dunk you, they were going to put something in the church to dunk you. And that's what happened to me. You know, I was 12 years old. They put a little white gown on me, and they got me in that, whatever they call it. It's not a font, because a font just holds a little bit of water. It's a big basin. And the preacher put a washcloth on my face, and he dunked me down in it. And I resent him to this day, because I think he held me down too long. I really do. Because I come up sputtering, and I walked out of that church and never came back into a church until, other than those few attempts trying to find something, until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous on a serious note. And I told my sponsor when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we all want to be different. You know, we all want to be an alcoholic and an addict and alcoholic and whatever, you know. And I was no different, you know. But I didn't have a real big drug history, you know. So I told my sponsor, I said, I'm an alcoholic and an atheist. And he said, George, let me tell you something. He said, as I understand it, he said, an atheist can prove the non-existence of God. You are so rum-dumb and so stupid, you can't prove the non-existence of anything, so please don't call yourself an atheist. As I understand it, an agnostic is a non-believer. So if you want to be an agnostic, that'll set me apart. So I said to everybody, I was an alcoholic and an agnostic. Then he looked at me and he said, George, let me tell you something. He said, there is a chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous called We Agnostics. It does not say George the Agnostic or the only agnostic in AA. It says We Agnostic. So I just gave up on that. I just became one of you all. You know, I just became a plain alcoholic, you know. And so that's what I started doing when I got here. And that was where I was with my alcoholism. And I wish I could stand up here today and tell you that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and I got on a big white horse and I rode out in the sunset and somebody said, who was that masked man? I said, hi-o, Silver. Everything was wonderful. But that isn't what happened. The hardest thing I ever did in my life was get sober. But the most rewarding thing I ever did in my life was to get sober. My life is sobriety. I'm grateful to the God of my understanding for allowing me to stay sober on a daily basis and to be able to give this program away if I can. You know, my whole goal is really, I believe it. I had a pigeon that asked me one time, said, what is the whole deal? I said, let me tell you what the whole deal is. When it's all over and we go to our higher power, to God, and he asks you, what did you do with the gift I gave you? I hope I can say I gave it away. Because if I didn't, it's not been worth it. So anyway, I started getting sober. Now from this point in my talk, I'm going to talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm not going to lecture about the 12 steps, and I'm not going to tell you how to do the 12 steps. All I'm going to do is tell you how I recovered through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and why I'm so grateful that I had a sponsor who explained to me and walked with me the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you why. From the point I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went a year and a half doing what Joey was talking about. You know, I didn't get drunk, but I was in and out. I was doing the AA waltz, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And nothing was going right in my life. And the reason is that I really hadn't taken the steps and I didn't know how to be sober. You know, we, and on a serious note, you know, I've had lots of friends that died, alcoholic friends that died. But I'm going to be real straight with you. They didn't die from a wet period. They died from a dry period. They committed suicide from a dry period because they couldn't handle sobriety. Not because they couldn't handle drinking. We muddle through the drinking. Somehow we get through the drinking. But living sober is a, oh, it's horrible. I mean, really. I mean, we're alcoholic. We start, whoa, you know. So, you know, after that year and a half, well, let me tell you, I was a suicidal drunk. Now, here's the type of suicidal drunk I was. I wanted to commit suicide by jumping in front of a parked car. Because I didn't want to hurt myself, you know. Now, I had a big suicide attempt. I got up over the Ohio River one time on the bridge. I drew a crowd up there. About three or four people were up there. And I didn't get too close to the rail because I didn't want to fall. And I always tell this because we never know when we may go out. You know, I mean, it's a daily program. And if I ever get in this situation, you'll know how to get me off the bridge. I called the guy that was, or somebody called the guy that was to be my sponsor. He wasn't my sponsor at that time, but he was a friend of mine. And he came up on the bridge and he said these magic words. He said, George, let's go down to Murphy's Bar and Grill and have a drink and talk about this. Well, I beat him off the bridge. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted someone to say, you know. But I'm here to tell you, after a year and a half of doing no work on George, just being stark raving sober, I seriously contemplated suicide. I walked up to a man's house whose sobriety dated back to 1944, and he was in Marietta, Ohio at the time, but he got sober in Pittsburgh. And I walked up to him, and that's why I think that all we people that's been in the program a while, we owe the newcomer the truth. And this man told me the truth. I went to Glenn, and I said, Glenn, you know, I'd be better off drunk than the way I am right now. And he looked me dead in the eyes, and he said, George, you would be better off drunk than the way you are right now. But he said, there's a way out. And I said, well, what would that be? And he said, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I had to admit that Mr. AA Agnostic didn't know anything about the 12 steps. I was just a dumb West Virginian. I didn't know anything about 12 steps. And I said, Glenn, would you walk me through the steps? Now, if there's anybody out here tonight that's hurting and got a lot of pain, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will cure anything. I mean, even hemorrhoids. I'm serious. Anybody had hemorrhoids that cured it? I guarantee you. Cured mine. Get somebody. You know, I use the term old timer, but let me tell you something. Old timer, somebody with 30 days of sobriety is an old timer to somebody in AA. Believe me, they are. Believe me. Because let me tell you something, when I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, a guy like me that had umpteen years, I didn't believe he was sober. You couldn't stay sober that long. Are you kidding me? That guy sitting over the corner said, well, I got 2 weeks. Man, that's who I want to listen to. And should listen to, really. I'm serious. Because the man knew how to stay sober 2 weeks. You know, I don't know if you know Sybil Corwin or not. Sybil was the first woman out in Los Angeles. And she got sober in 1941. And she went to her first meeting in the Los Angeles group there. And after 2 weeks, they had gotten a bunch of letters from the General Service Office from the Jack Alexander story. And there was like 38 women in the L.A. area that needed to find Alcoholics Anonymous. So the chairman called Sybil up front and said, you got 2 weeks sobriety now. You go call on these 38 women before next week. And Sybil looked at him and said, what am I supposed to tell him? I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm 2 weeks sober. He said, that's what you tell him. You knock on the door and you tell them you've got 2 weeks of sobriety, and if they want 2 weeks, to come with you down to the Los Angeles meeting. And you see, I did that in my first couple of months, even in that pain. There was an old street drunk up there, and he and I would go on Friday mornings, and he had an old beat-up station wagon. We'd pick up these drunks and throw them in and take them to the ATU unit, you know, over to the Nut House. Some of them got sober. I didn't know what I was doing, other than the fact that as long as I was picking up a drunk, I wasn't picking up a drink. So now, you know, I had to start looking at the 12 steps. And you know what the key was with me? You see, when I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had turned around. You know, they think we do step one 100%. I don't believe that. Because the way I had done step one, or said I was an alcoholic, I thought my life was unmanageable because I drank. Therefore, if I quit drinking, my life should be manageable. Does not work that way. Glenn looked at me and said, George, let me tell you something. The first step of Alcoholics Anonymous says we're powerless over alcohol, hyphen, which means there's a separate thought coming, that our lives had become unmanageable. That is what got me into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my friend, because if I could take it that way, I realized that my life was unmanageable whether I drank or I didn't drink. Didn't make any difference. So then I had to go look at step two. You notice it came to believe the power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Well, there's a couple things about that step I didn't like. You know, at that point, you know, the God thing wasn't a big thing with me. And insanity, you know, you could take my wife, beat my kids, do whatever, but don't call me nuts. You know what I mean? I couldn't handle that. He started explaining both things to me. He said, George, let me tell you something. He said, it says, came to believe. That means a passage of time. That means that you came to believe. That doesn't mean you come to believe. You came to believe. And you have to start with a belief. You take action on that belief, you get results on that action, and then you have faith. So, I started working. And then I had to understand, you know, I was one of those, I walked in and I thought, well, you're telling me to find God. So I'd very sarcastically, I'd go over and open the closet. You know, if you're in there, God, come on out. Then Glenn looked at me and says, dummy, let me tell you something. The ABCs of Alcoholics Anonymous says God could and would if he were sought. It does not say God could and would if he were found. And it's in the seeking that we find him. So we got that covered. But then we had the nuts idea, you know. Well, back in West Virginia where I'm from, they started ATU units, alcoholic training units. I don't know what they were training them to do, but they put them in the Nut House. They had these units, you know, and it was a detox and a treatment. I don't know what it was, but anyway. I used to think that the insanity they were talking about was all the crazy things I did drinking, you know. And Glenn looked at me and said, let me tell you something. He said, if you give an 87-year-old choir mother a fifth of liquor, she's going to do some crazy things, but that does not make her an alcoholic. So then I realized that when it says a mental obsession coupled with a physical addiction, a mental obsession, obsession on anything. If I tonight told you that I used to hide toilet paper under my bed, I had toilet paper all over my house, I put it in my car, the cop stopped me. I admitted to having two sheets. You'd say, he's crazy as hell. Well, let me tell you something. I did the same thing with alcohol. I was either coming off of a drunk, thinking about where I was going to get a drink. My whole life was consumed with that obsession. And that is mental illness. That is insanity. My sponsor went one time with me to the ATU unit, and we went to, he went to give his story. He was going to give his AA story, and he got up and was telling his story, and all of a sudden, someone from the other side, you know, came walking in. This guy thought he was the sheriff. I mean, he believed he was the sheriff. And had two pistols, you know, toy pistols. And he sat down in the front row, and my sponsor gave his AA talk. And after he was through, the little sheriff came up and he said, "Can I ask you a question?" My sponsor is like me, learned right away. You let them do anything they want to do, you know, because you don't know what they're going to do. So he said, "Well, sure, you can ask me a question." He said, "Well, if alcohol did all that to you, why'd you drink it?" Now, that guy's still in the nut house. My sponsor and I walked out on the street, you know. But then I learned what kind of insanity was. That's what the insanity is with us alcoholics, it's the obsession. And I believe that. So then I got to step three, and Glenn got down on his knees with me, and we took step three, and he explained to me, he said, "George, what we're doing is that we're, you know," I looked at step three, and to me it looked like perfection. You know, I thought, what I'm doing here is I'm going to turn my life, shoot it upstairs to God, my life, my will, and he's going to shoot it back down, and then I just walk, and everybody kisses the hem of my garment, because I'm perfect, you know. Glenn said, "No, it don't work that way." He said, "First of all, the step says, in his care and protection, you don't turn it over. You turn your life and will in his care and protection, and he looks after you. Still your life and your will. And it's not a step." He explained to me, you know, I go to a lot of AA meetings, and they drive me crazy, some people, because they'll sit and say, "Well, you know, at 8 o'clock, I turned my life and will over to God, and 8:30, I took it back. At 9 o'clock, I turned it back over, and at 9:30, I took it back." That would drive me crazy. Glenn said, "There's only one way to take this step back, or two ways." He said, "One way is to get drunk. The other way is for you to come back to me. We'll get back down on our knees, and we'll tell God we don't want to live this way of life." Now, Glenn's gone, so it's going to be hard for me to do that part, and I haven't taken a drink. So I don't think that I have taken that step back. But I'll tell you this, every morning I get up, I remember who I am, what I am, and where the solution lies. The first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I reaffirm it every day of my life. I don't always live in God's will, because we're all human. You know, the steps say that. You know, it talks about character defects. We humbly ask him to take them away, but, later on it says when they come back. It doesn't say if they come back. It says when they come back. We still have those tools to get rid of them. So I took the third step with Glenn, and I believe I joined Alcoholics Anonymous that day. I believe I tried to do. He read to me page 25 of the big book where it says we have but two alternatives. One, to go to the bitter end, blotting out everything. The other, to try spiritual help. And we did this because we wanted to. And to me, that's the third step, you know, and it's joining Alcoholics Anonymous. So then I got to the fourth step. Now, you know, all of us alcoholics know how important the fourth step. I knew how important the fourth step was the second day I was in AA. I don't know how we do it, but we know, boy, that's an important step. We don't like it, but, we. So Glenn said, you know, he sent me off. He said, "George, this is a preparation step because you're going to do an action in step five, but you prepare by putting down your list, and you do it by the big book." You know, I was one of those. I'd go to meetings, and if somebody sat at a meeting and said, "You know, I went into John one morning and sat there in the John and took my fourth step," I'd try it. You know, I did everything, you know. One time I took a pamphlet to a meeting to my sponsor. I said, "You know, I know how to do the fourth step now. I got this pamphlet here." Now, it amazes me. Now, I'm not talking about dentists or people here. I'm talking about, it amazes me there's a lot of people outside of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous writing pamphlets, telling us how to work our program. Yeah, it just blows me away. But anyway, I thought, well, this is the way to do it. So I said, I'm going to take the step like this. Now, at this point, I need to tell you that my sponsor, and that's one of the reasons I'm in this coat and tie. My sponsor said, George, when you get up at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, you look the best you can, and you clean up your language, and you respect Alcoholics Anonymous. So I can't tell you what he told me to do with the pamphlet. But after the meeting, if you want to meet me someplace, I'll tell you what he's... Anyway, we threw that out. Then I was sitting in a meeting one night, and somebody said, oh, you know, I was so hard on myself. I was just so... I mean, I need to put down some assets. You know, I'm so hard on myself. Well, first of all, Glenn said, you know, Bill says in the book what kind of inventory it is. An inventory of unsalable goods. Ain't no assets in there. It's unsalable goods. So I went to my sponsor. I told him, you know, I said, I've been so hard on myself. You know, I need to take some assets. And he said, George, let me tell you something. The type of drunk you are, he said, just the fact that you think you have assets is a liability. So I threw that out and did it like the book said to do it. You know, then I took my inventory. Then I got to the place where I thought, whoa, here's why we don't want to take an inventory. Now I've got to tell it to God, another human being, myself. He invited God in when we took this inventory. I'm a Catholic, and it is not a confession. Or at least Glenn explained to me it's not a confession. There's nobody going to give you absolution, not going to do anything. It's two drunks talking together and joining the human race. I went to my sponsor, and I took this inventory with him, and we sat down, you know, and I thought, whoa, I'll throw this with him because this will really get him, you know. Maybe we can end it short, you know, real quick. And he just looked at me, laughed. He said, oh, is that all you did? Let me tell you about what I did. I said, so it was over. You know, and I took the inventory, but you know what it did for me? I don't know about you all, but I was a alley dodging drunk. I could not walk down the streets of my hometown with my head up high. If I saw Dennis coming at me and I knew I didn't want to see him, I'd duck down an alley and go out another street. This was the start of me being able to walk the streets of my hometown with dignity. And that is priceless. Believe me, it is priceless. The way I lived anyway is priceless. So then I did what he told me to, you know, we did the inventory, and he told me in the sixth step, he told me to go home and take down the book and reflect on what I'd taken. And anytime a step says become entirely ready, to me it means prayer. You know, I'm going to have to ask God to get me prepared. Give me the power to do this. And the seventh step is action. I humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. Well, you know, that's the first time Bill's used the word humble in the steps. But, you know, you hear this at a lot of meetings. A lot of alcoholics will say, if you think you have humility, you don't. I don't believe that. I really don't, and I'll tell you why. A new drunk walking off the streets that comes in and asks for help has a degree of humility. Believe me, he does. I know because I did it. If you come to believe in the God of your understanding, that takes a degree of humility. If you get on your knees and you take a third step and turn your life and your will over to him, takes a degree of humility. Every step up to the seventh step takes a degree of humility. And that's why he wanted you to have that, because not only does it explain about humility, but it explains what kind of mood or what kind of place we are supposed to be when we ask God to remove these. You know, it doesn't say arrogantly ask God. It says humbly ask God. So anyway, I did that seventh step, and I got the eighth step. And, you know, here's where, you know, I was the type drunk I was, you know. When I was 17 years old, I was walking down the streets of my hometown. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was half drunk. And there was a little bar upstairs on the second floor. And, I frequent every once in a while. So I went to go to the door, and it was locked. Well, we alcoholics have paranoia every once in a while. So I thought, well, they're up there partying without me. So I just tore the door down. Went upstairs, got in the bar. There wasn't anybody there. They had closed, you know. So I forgot about that until I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And now we're making this list, you know. And so that's the first person I put there. Oh, I've got to make amends to this bar. I tore down their door. Glenn looked at me and said, boy, you are a dummy. He said, first of all, he said, that bar has changed hands 100 times since you were there. He said, the step does not say hurt. The step says harm. And harm is mental or physical, but it's lasting. And he said, let's get the people down there that we've harmed. Family, employers, friends. Those. The bartender that threw you out, who cares? You know, you hurt I hurt when my bottom hit the cement when he threw me out, you know, so... Just because I made fun of his mother, shouldn't, you know. So, I don't worry about him, but I do worry about the harm. So I made that list. Then I got to the 9th step and I had to go make the amends. Now my sponsor, I don't know about yours, but my sponsor was one of those guys that he didn't think sorry was enough. He said, you sure are sorry, but you know. He said, that step means whatever it takes to make it right. It does not mean I'm sorry, and especially if you're going to do the same action again. He said, you need to go make amends. An example is, I told you before I was a traveling salesman. One time I went through my territory because I had a competitor that really was selling more than I was selling. So I went in the whole territory and lied about him. Went and told all these wild stories and just he was no good and da 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 da. So when I get to make the amend, I went, my sponsor nudging me, of course, go talk to him. So I went in, I said, you know, my sponsor says I need to make this right. So whatever it takes to make it right. Thinking that he would say, oh, George, it's okay. I'm glad you're being sober now. He looked at me and said, I'll tell you what'll make it right. Go back through the territory and tell every one of those people that you lied. And I had to do that. But you know what? That amend means more to me than a lot of them. Because it was hard work. Because it took something from me. And that's the way he believed, you know. Then we came to 10, 11, and 12, which I think are really the maintenance steps. And in the 10th step, you know, it says continued, which means I'm even dumb West Virginian, but I know continued means I've done it before. So... I think it's like the 4th step. But at this point, we're doing it on a daily basis, and we're trying to keep our side of the street clean. And then we come to this 11th step, which is my favorite step. And that step, you know, I used to say, my sponsor used to say, George, prayer and meditation means, prayer means talking to God, meditation means listening to God. He said, the type of drunk you are, you need to listen more than you need to talk. So meditation was real important, but it's not the yin-yang, da-da-da-da, you know, holy, holy meditation that worked for me. What he told me to do is to clear my mind and try to come in contact with my God. And you know what? There's been some brief moments that's happened, but that's all I need. You know, I don't need it every day. And, so, you know, but I always thought that step was the first part of it was the most important, but it's not to me. The last part is important, and I overlooked the last part. You know, it says that we pray for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Well, His will for me, I understand. I think it has to do with being sober. He wants me to do anything that I have to do to stay sober. I believe that's His will for me. But what I need as a drunk or as a human being or as anything is the power to carry that out. You know, I've never been, I find the power, well, I go to my church also, but I find the power there. But I find the power in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been to an AA meeting that I haven't felt the power of God. And, you know, we have an old guy up there in West Virginia that really believes that God's an alcoholic. Now, the reason he thinks God's an alcoholic is that God's at every AA meeting he's ever been to, open and closed, and you know you got to be an alcoholic to be at a closed meeting. So I don't. I believe the Al-Anons could have a claim on that, you know. And I believe anybody could have a claim on that. But I do believe, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. And then I got to the 12th step, which I think explains everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. It means that if I do those previous 11 steps, not perfect or not anything, but just work on it, I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, that I'll have a spiritual awakening. And we try to carry this message to other alcoholics. That doesn't say wet alcoholics or dry alcoholics. It just says alcoholics. You know, I think because of the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's your responsibility every time I walk into a meeting to 12-step me. But then again, it's my responsibility to 12-step you, because we help each other. Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, works. Not because I stand up and tell you how strong I am, but I tell you how weak I am. If we share weaknesses, all of a sudden we become strong. And believe me, I believe that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous works. So, and try to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I always like to close my talk with a story. When I was 5 years sober, I moved back to my hometown, and I sponsored a barber, a drunk there in West Virginia, and Pete was a loser. All of us called him losers. You know, you have to understand, I was 5 years sober, very, very spiritually arrogant, probably sit on the right hand of Bill Wilson. But I sponsored him, and he was in and out. So he's a loser. Well, all of a sudden, Pete got sober again, and I was sponsoring him. He had about 18 months of sobriety. And he went out again and went down to North Carolina, 43 years old, liver burst, and died. And they brought him back to West Virginia to bury him. And I went down to the funeral home really to see his family. And Pete was over in the casket. And I looked in the funeral home there. Now, in West Virginia, we don't just throw them in the ground. You know, we go to the funeral home a couple days, and then we throw them in the ground. But I went in that funeral home. There was this big old country boy standing there, and he had them rosy cheeks. You know, when I was a kid, I don't know if you all understand this or not, but in West Virginia, the mamas used to take washcloths, dry washcloths, because it was important to have rosy cheeks. And before you went to school, they'd rub your cheeks with those things. You know. Well, this guy had them big rosy cheeks. And he looked big. You know, he looked good. He looked familiar to me. So I didn't say anything to him. The next night I went back to the funeral home, the guy's still there. Or he'd come back again. And I finally, it got to me. And I walked over to him and I said, let me tell you something. I said, you look familiar to me. Shouldn't I know you? He said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, you should know me. He said, I've been sober 3.5 years. And he said, I got my family back. And he said, I'm going to 3 meetings a week. I live out in the country. And still couldn't remember him. You know, Mr. Arrogant had this all together. Couldn't remember this guy. Finally, I said to him, well, give me a clue. He said, I said, who was your sponsor? You said, I and your sponsor came out to talk to you. He said, well, you're looking at my sponsor in the casket. He said, Pete's my sponsor. Now, let me tell you something, friends. Pete, Mr. Arrogant just went on his way, forgot that drunk, and did what he had to do. But Pete, you know what he did in his sober moments? between his drunks, he talked to that man about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked to his family. He took him to meetings. He was a good sponsor to that man, and the man loved him. So I'm here to tell you that from that day on, I don't think there is any loser in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think winners are losers who keep trying. And I really believe, and I hope, tonight I only carried 1/10 of the message that Pete had carried to that old drunk back in West Virginia. Thank you. I love you very much.